for those of you who will be around Holden in the next 10 days or so, we'll be doing our Rainbow on the Mountaintop emphasis at Holden Village, which is another way in which Holden is itself attempting to reflect the larger society and, in fact, the larger globe, and to become more self-aware and multicultural in its very being. So as we lead into that, I thought it might be helpful to just review a little bit where we are with race relations today. This is a sort of headline romp through particularly the economic and political dimensions, but then I hope we could talk some about the sort of psychological dimensions of where we are with race in the United States today. Let me just say that I have been convinced since my youth, some time spent in the civil rights movement, that race relations is the public dilemma in the United States. Gunnar Myrdal's classic 1940s book called race relations the American dilemma, and it is the American dilemma. If there is an Achilles heel to American democracy, if there is a place where the rest of the world looks at the United States and says, my goodness, can't they do any better than this, it is in the area of race relationships. It is, obviously, it is the only issue that this country has ever been involved in a war over on our own front. The Civil War was fought over this issue. And every time the majority white population of the United States sort of thinks that that the race relations front has quieted down and can be swept under the rug and forgotten about, it always finds a way to pop itself back into all of our consciousness. So it does seem to me, when we're thinking about public agendas in the United States, that there's no more important set of lenses to put on than to think about race relations. One other preliminary comment, it does seem to me clear that in the United States anyway, are you looking at me to do this? Do something with the mic, David?
I'm going.
Okay. In the United States at least, the multicultural dimension of the United States itself is shifting so quickly that our awareness of and consciousness about and involvement in multicultural reality needs to take off at a precipitous rate at this point in our history, it seems to me. There are lots of indications of, in fact, how multicultural a society we are becoming. Within 15 years, more than one-third of the workforce will be so-called minorities. Many, many cities are already majority-minority in their compositions. So we are in a position where we need to, in fact, I think, redefine our language and begin to think about white Europeans as in the minority. Certainly true globally. Those people who identify with that kind of an ethnic background make up something like 10% of the global population. So it seems to me that if we're going to be realistic and creative about the ways in which we construct our public life in a changing United States, we really do have to refocus consistently on what it means to be a multicultural nation. It also seems to me, just in passing, that is the glory and the hope of the United States. That, in fact, if there is one thing that the rest of the globe is interested in at this point about the United States, it's precisely that kind of multicultural reality and that kind of the open border notion of the United States. The fact that this still is, at least at some level, an experiment in multicultural living. It would be marvelous to have a set of leaders in the United States who got as excited as they should about that set of possibilities rather than regarding it as a set of problems. Okay. So all of this is to sort of frame and contextualize a few things that I want to do in the next few minutes and then have some time for talking together. Clearly, we could be talking about a variety of multicultural realities in the United States. The fastest growing ethnic and racial group in the United States is the variety of Hispanics in the United States. Predominantly Mexican, second group Puerto Rican, but lots and lots of both Central and South Americans also, all the way through the United States, particularly in the Southwest and in cities all over the place. There's lots to be said about the challenges and opportunities of becoming a bilingual, bicultural kind of society in that framework, which we'll skip over tonight. There's lots to be said about the terrific increase in Asian populations in the United States and the ways in which a variety of Asian immigrant groups are contributing in certainly new numbers and new and exciting ways to various parts of our life. Obviously, the need constantly to reorient ourselves toward the American Indian experience is always with us. But there's something about the black and white scene, in the United States anyway, that continues to appear to me absolutely central to the United States experience and to our consciousness. So that's what I want to concentrate on. But I want to concentrate on that not without apologies and not without noting that there's a much larger multicultural context that needs to be thought about as well. But black and white is sort of at the center of the American dilemma. So I just want to ask real briefly, in economic terms, and then briefly in political terms, where we are today, and then think a little bit with you, I hope, about what attitudes are like, particularly in the majority communities, since we don't have that many black folks here to talk with us about it yet, although we will within the next couple of weeks. Economically, the legacy, of course, for black people in the United States is a tough one from slavery on. Where are we today, and what's been happening? Let me just do a couple of overall things and then break it down a little bit in what seems to me to be a more helpful way. In brief, the general economic conditions of black people in the United States, it seems to me, if you look at the numbers, began improving markedly after World War II and really shot up during the 1960s. The poverty rate for black people in 1960 was something like 55%. And through the now much maligned Great Society programs and the War on Poverty, all of this stuff that we've heard in the last 10 years didn't work. The poverty rate in the black community was reduced to 32% by 1970. In the late 1970s and through the first half of the decade of the 1980s, the poverty rate for blacks in the United States began rising once again. So, and then has leveled off by all indications from about 1984 to the present. So you've got a curve that looks, that in terms of general economic conditions, that peaks someplace around 1970 in terms of economic conditions for black folks, and then begins to decline in the late 70s, in early 80s, and levels off at a much higher level, obviously, than 1960. This is the overall poverty rate. This scribbling up in the corner here somebody was referring to reminds us that before World War II, the poverty rate in black communities was something like 70%. You know, so we really have, there is reason over the longer haul to be somewhat hopeful about the overall conditions of black people in the United States, although the decline has been quite precipitous given the progress from 60 to about 76. A couple of other quick indicators. Unemployment rate for black males in 1960, nearly 10%. 1970, where there was virtually full employment in the economy, the unemployment rate for black males also was down to about 3.7%. You need to factor in the military at that point. Then by the mid-1980s, we're back up to a 19% unemployment rate, and I think that's down now to about 16%. This is about a 1984 figure. We're back down to about 16% unemployment rate for black males in the economy.
Julie, yeah. Isn't that a misleading figure, though? I mean, I've heard a lot about, you know, unemployment rate. The way it gets set really ignores a lot of people who are out of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's very low.
All of these statistics, particularly about unemployment, need to be taken with a grain of salt. Many economies count people who are called discouraged workers in their statistics. The United States, the Census Bureau, the Labor Department of Labor Statistics doesn't do that in the United States. So people who have given up and who are no longer looking for work, or who in the case of lots of folks in the inner city economies have found other ways. There's a huge underground economy in most American cities, and the people in that economy who are no longer looking for work are not counted in this unemployment rate, which is how you get from this kind of a rate to a real rate of about 60-65% in a lot of urban communities. Family income. Also, you see this sort of up-down kind of pattern. In 1960, black family income was 55% of white family income, just a little over half of white family income. It rose a bit in relation to white family income, 60% by 1970, but is back down in the 1984 statistics to about 56% of white family income, which is, I think, what I saw for 1987 recently as well. One other indication about problems we've had with poverty rates in the 1980s. Income from 80 to 85 of the poorest 40% of families in the United States dropped $236. Income for the most wealthy 40% of American people went up $2,195 per family, right? Families who started in the top 40% are now a little over $2,000 by 1985, wealthier in constant dollars than they were in 1980. And for the top 10% in terms of wealth, $7,000 wealthier. So there is a pattern of redistribution, as Jesse Jackson keeps telling us, from the poor to the wealthy in the United States through the 1980s. And there are lots and lots of figures that back that up. Well, it seems to me that this is not the most helpful way to think, though, about what's happening to black communities in the United States in terms of their relationship to the economy. And that, in fact, the major factor going on in the United States in the black community over the last 15 years is the separation of a still expanding black middle class from a rapidly expanding black underclass. This is radically new in the black community. If you read the classic black literature or any sociology or history about either life in the agricultural South or after migration, life in the northern cities in black communities, you get a sense of a community in which class lines virtually don't exist. Lines that divide by income virtually don't exist. You get the successful preachers and politicians and business people living next to the poorest of the poor. And there is a kind of extended family life. We don't want to go into a whole sort of sociology of black community, which is quite different from most white communities in lots of ways. But there is a whole set of interrelationships and extended family and sharing and a variety of mechanisms for making economic life go forward as an entity, as a whole community. If you read some of the classic sociology works about urban northern urban ghettos in the 20s and 30s and even 40s, books like Black Chicago or The Making of a Black Metropolis, they just sort of teem with this sense of intertwined community, and communities where organizations are just ubiquitous all over the place. There are clubs and churches and singing groups and sororities and fraternities and a life that is just flowering institutionally. All of this within a context of 70% overall poverty, right? But if you get a sense of sort of vibrancy about that, and when you talk to black folks who came up in that kind of community, they'll tell you about that. Now, in the last 20 years, 15 or 20 years, and accelerating certainly through this last decade, something radically different has happened to black communities. And it is the dilemma that you will talk with black folks about if you're in cities these days. And it is the separation by class for the first time of the black community, mostly because of policies made by white folks, I have to say. Mostly because of the suburbanization of metropolitan America, which is, of course, fed by federal policy with homeowners loans and with veterans loans and the sort of burgeoning of the suburbs in the 1950s and 60s, which seduced not only white but black middle class folks as well into suburban living. A whole range of, now we know in retrospect, ill-conceived 1950s and 60s urban renewal programs, which basically tore down, anybody who's been to any city has seen it, particularly the older cities, but some in the new too, tore down mile upon mile upon mile of older tenement housing usually indiscriminately, not figuring, not sort of doing it selectively and saying, well, here's an old building that's not going to be worth anything, and here's a really neat brick structure that can survive for another 300 years if we do a little work on it. They weren't discriminant about it. They leveled entire square miles all over the place, particularly in the older northern cities, and then rebuilt them, often with public housing, so that you get a kind of concentration of poverty, which is absolutely new in the black experience in the United States, and raises a huge set of problems that the black community has never faced, and certainly that the white community has never come to grips with. These underclass neighborhoods and cities are terrific challenges, it seems to me, to all of us. There are two explanations, let's to be very simple, about what's going on, what's causing the urban underclass, besides the sort of geographic and policy-oriented explanation that I just gave you. It's, to be real simple about it, you either say there's something wrong with those people, right? And they're lazy and they don't want to work and they have short time horizons and their family life is screwed up and they've got too many children and you know, the laundry list of problems with the black underclass is virtually limitless. Or it seems to me, more helpfully, just to outline briefly my alternative anyway, and other people's too, it seems to me you can understand what's going on in cities as the result of a huge shift in the economy of cities. That most of our ancestors who came to cities, ours being at least European ones, did in fact experience a kind of ladder of American economic growth for themselves. That is, if they came over without any education, they got immediately into the labor market and they stepped onto the first rung of the ladder without an education, with no necessarily no previous experience, with no credentials except a willingness to work and often a strong back. It was the day of the industrial city, the booming of the industrial city, the huge growth of manufacturing and blue-collar work in the United States provided this first step for lots and lots of our ancestors. Well, what's happened? To make a fairly complicated story, oversimplified, this step isn't there anymore. So the people who are in cities now without work don't have a first step of the ladder. They're just falling down. There is no more first step of the ladder. My own city, Chicago, in the last 15 years has lost something like 400,000 industrial jobs. 400,000 jobs, most of which are in the first step of that ladder. They pay well, they're hard work, they're often dirty, but they pay pretty well, and more important, they lead to the second step and a third. And you can support a family on it, and you can buy a house, and you can get into another neighborhood, and you can. There is a sense of mobility about those steel mill jobs, which are virtually gone from the older cities at this point. It used to be that you could get into the economy, work your way up, have your family, and then the next generation would get into the education system. Now it's just reversed. If you aren't into the education system and increasingly successful and more credentialed in it, you can't get into the economy. So that at the same time as the economy has collapsed, that is particularly the first rung of the step in American cities, the rest of the social structures around the economy have collapsed. Contemporaneously with the disappearance of this first step is the degradation of the urban school systems, right? So that just when schooling becomes the absolute required prerequisite for entry into the economy in a way that will get you up into it, the school systems disintegrate entirely. Now, people who understand the way racial dynamics often work in the United States will say that that's not an accident. That in fact, we tend to pay over the centuries in the United States much less attention to our public institutions when they become predominantly minority. We can talk about that. So the alternative explanation is not that here are acres and acres and high rises of worthless and unworthy folks, but that here are acres and acres and high rises of people for whom the economy doesn't exist, who have absolutely no way, to get up onto the first rung of that ladder like everybody else is expected. Well, I think that that is a major, major challenge, not only for American cities, but for the whole of American society to be facing in the next 10 years. And I don't know that there's anything out there that I see at this point that's very that is nearly serious enough about the scope of this problem. We could talk a lot about that, but let me just leave it there. Let me just turn for a moment then to the political dimensions of life for Black America at this point, and say that there, in the political life, it seems to me, we should talk about this together. There is a good deal of movement, excitement, possibility, hope. It's still true that although Blacks make up about 12% of the American population, Black elected officials are about 1.5% of all elected officials in the United States. But that's up from about 0.4%, right, as recently as 15 years ago. The major turning point for Black political life in the United States, of course, was as a result of the Civil Rights Movement, and then the passage in 1965 of the Voting Rights Act, which put the federal government on the side of Blacks in the South in opening up the possibility then of their participating in the electoral life of the South. Undeniably, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is the most important piece of legislation in the 20th century for Black folks, and has opened up a wide set of opportunities for Black participation, particularly in the South, but in other areas of life as well. As recently as 10 years ago, there were something like 80 Black mayors in the United States. There's now over 700 Black mayors I think, cities over 10,000 in the United States. There's something like 35 Black mayors of cities over 50,000. So we're talking about fairly substantial cities in the United States. So that while the percentage is still far lower than the population would indicate would be fair, the indication of huge growth in the number of Black elected officials is really quite astounding. Just for those of you who walk in Washington at this point, the Black population of Washington is about 2.6%. And you at this point have the equivalent of 0% of Black elected officials in the state of Washington. That is 17 out of 7,500. 17 out of 7,500 in the state of Washington. If there are any Minnesotans around, your Black population is about 1.2%, and you also have 0% Black elected officials. In fact, 9 of 19,000 in your state. A word or two about Blacks in the electoral process. I think there's so much to say, but let me just say one comment. It is still true, almost unanimously, that while Black folks will more frequently than not vote for white candidates, it is almost never the case that white folks vote for Black candidates. Almost never. So that almost all of the Black elected officials are from jurisdictions of whatever size which have substantial Black populations. It's virtually impossible for a Black candidate to be elected with majority white support. Whereas the reverse, Black folks voting for white candidates is commonplace. Just something to keep in mind as you think about, particularly the dynamics around something like a Jesse Jackson campaign. Let me just, there's so much more to do, but I want to really listen to you for a little bit and respond to questions. Let me say a couple of things about Jesse and then split from these opening remarks. Jackson, it seems to me, is after the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Jackson is the most important political phenomenon in American Black life. To understand where Black life has been in the United States and what the possibilities are for the American Black community in the future, it seems to me we could spend just as much time as we possibly can trying to understand what the dynamics are of Jackson's campaign. Let me mention just a couple of things about what I think the dynamics are, since I've worked with Jackson a little bit in Chicago for the last 20 years. I think that Jackson has sort of embodied himself a kind of consciousness shift in the black community, in the politicized black community, in the activist black community, from what I would call a movement politics to, in fact, an electoral politics, right? That Jackson has, obviously, his roots in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and there's a kind of consciousness, of the outsider, a consciousness of the rebel, of the protester in movement politics, which sort of determines a lot of who Jesse is and what he's carried into the 70s and 80s. To watch the shift from a kind of movement mentality to an increasingly astute political mentality, an electoral political mentality, has been for me one of the most exciting American political stories of the century, certainly of my lifetime. To watch even Jackson's growth from 1984 to 1988 has been most interesting. He's increasingly sophisticated about a variety of the realities of American political life in ways that we might want to talk about. I have been impressed the times I've been with the Jackson campaign. I was with him in Iowa for a while. I have been impressed with the way in which that campaign has reached white folks. I've also been impressed, around Chicago anyway, at the way in which it's reached Hispanic people. I never expected in my lifetime to be in a Grange Hall in the middle of a small town in Iowa listening to a group of white farm people from small town Iowa shouting, "I am somebody," back at Jesse Jackson. I mean, it was a mind-blowing kind of scene. Something obviously was happening with those folks. There was some connection there. Not all of them obviously voted for Jesse, but at least there was some kind of an emotional bonding that was going on. And to watch the content of Jackson's message expand from a kind of parochially defined politics, parochial, that is, within the context of the black community and its definition of what the political issues are. To watch the growth of that politics into a more and more global kind of perspective, and a perspective that, whether you agree with him or not, at least touches on a variety of issues that are clearly not simply affecting the black community, as that farm scene reminded me anyway. Finally, the other thing it seems to me that Jesse has done that's interesting and hasn't been done really even by Dr. King, I think, is to unite the various factions of the black community, at least around this particular candidacy. The enthusiasm for the Jackson campaign in the black community really does transcend this class separation. It really has begun to bring people from the black middle class and people from the black poor back together in some very interesting kinds of ways. Jackson himself symbolically moves most often in the black poor communities, particularly in cities. But obviously he draws a lot of his financial support from the black middle class and professional class. So there is a kind of reunification in the person of Jackson and in this political project that he's engaged in of the major splits within the black community. There's also a reunification of another major split in the black community between the rural South and the urban North. And Jesse sort of, again, embodies both of those communities. He stresses both his Carolina roots and his northern urban experience. So that, to a remarkable degree, in one person, it seems to me, the incredible diversity of the American black community gets somehow played out. And that's quite exciting to see, and I don't think it's happened even in the movement days with Dr. King. Well, all of that leads me to just end this then on a at least hopefully open note. It seems to me that a long, dark period, decade, for much of black America, a decade of decline, a decade of separation of the folks, a decade of really some despair. If you read black writers at all, and poets and novelists, you'll hear this tone over the last 10 or 15 years, that the hope of the movements of the 60s really had disappeared. But that there seems to be something going on now in the black community nationally that really does begin to resound with hope. As in so much else, though, that goes on in the black community, much of what will happen will depend on the white response, will depend on the response of the wider culture. Is there an openness in the wider culture? Is there a willingness to begin to deal in ways that recognize some equal power relationships? Is there a willingness to rethink some public policy positions and recognize what has happened in years on this topic? And I don't know exactly why, but stop it. All right, let's talk about this for a bit. Yes, sir.
Do you know this forced busing, which was still is, it's an issue to sort of mix up the races. So what's your comment and what effect does that have on their economic status and political and all that sort of stuff?
Well, we could talk about busing a lot. Personally and politically, I have never been very interested in busing. It has seemed to me to be a white solution that doesn't get at any of the issues, that doesn't get at the equity issues and how it is that we provide people with a decent education for this kind of an economy and this kind of a situation. In most northern cities, blacks are more isolated in schools now than they were 20 years ago. In most northern cities, and I think in the South too, blacks and whites are more isolated in terms of their living situations. We are a more segregated society now than we were 20 years ago. So, whatever one says about busing, it certainly hasn't broken down any of the sort of American apartheid. I mean, there really is a sense in which we live in an apartheid. We sometimes get a little self-righteous about thinking about South Africa, but there's a way in which the institutional barriers between the races in the United States are every bit as strong as they are in South Africa, just a little less legal, a little less formally legalistic. That is, the Constitution doesn't contain them, but all the economic and social structures do, so what do you need them for? So, I mean, I guess my reaction is busing remains an emotional kind of thing for people. They get exercised about it, although not many black people do that I know. But it hasn't had much of an effect, and I don't see it as a major policy tool as we attack education problems in the future. Some do and some don't. I mean, there's a wide variety of. I think that if I had to guess at general movement of opinion in the black community, I think that the hopes that some had for busing as an integration tool, as a way really to begin to mix folks up, some, not all, had for that. That those hopes have really been dashed in lots of ways. And that they recognize now that many more of the issues are sort of at their core are economic issues and are tougher to get at than simply trying to mix folks, particularly artificially like that.
One comment on busing, I come from Boston, which had a very painful busing history. And at least what happened in Boston was the legislators and judicial people who enforced busing all lived in the white suburbs where their children didn't have to do it. And the people who were set against each other in the busing issue were all working class people, both white and people of color, who didn't get to make the decisions about it. So that it partly comes out as a class thing, where the people making the decisions are more upper and middle class and don't have to live with it. So that's one of the discrepancies that ended up leaving a legacy of divisions that the idea in the first place was to get rid of some of the divisions. But
sure,
a lot of the white ethnic working class people in Boston then moved out to the suburbs to avoid busing. So that's another of the
complications. That's right. It's another way in which the whole question of busing gets just limited in its scope.
And people getting pitted against each other who really could have a lot more unity.
That's right.
I mean, they have in some ways, a common, a lot in common that then they don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm from Seattle, mm-hmm. and I think I have my statistics at least approximately correct. Since mm-hmm. about 1970, the population in Seattle Public Schools has dropped over 50% from something like 100,000 students, about 45 or so. And it was in the early 70s that Seattle began its voluntary busing program. And I don't know if there are other factors operating in this, but I think one factor was the busing, and people over the years became increasingly disillusioned with the long bus rides that their children were having, so that the white middle class either sent their kids to private schools or moved out to the surrounding smaller cities where there wasn't busing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Seattle is a good example of a city that experienced some real
problems. I'm sure busing wasn't the only cause for that, but I'm sure it contributed to some degree. It's a common kind of story. I think the other cause you got to talk about is by all measures, the decline in quality of the public schools. That's a perceived reality and also a statistically accurate reality.
I'd like to get your opinion. Some of us would see, I'll use an analogy, some of us would see the drug problem of the cities as a not simply a people coming in and selling a sector, but actually a conspiracy to destroy the city, and that the people who are often caught are the lower echelon, that's who gets all the publicity, that's the people in the jails, etc. None of the big people rarely have ever get caught in this thing. So in a sense, it's a conspiracy that is being managed up above. You alluded a little bit earlier. Is there, in your own mind, whether this is overt, people sitting around the table and saying, well, we're going to do this to black people, we're going to do this to the poor working, but is there at least a covert conspiracy where jobs of working people are being taken away, being shifted out of our country, where the schools are no longer, our urban schools are no longer a great financial, we're not putting a lot of money in that these days, we're putting our money elsewhere. I don't know, it just seems to me that it's more than just happenstance, that either overtly or covertly, or either by our silence or whatever, that we are allowing some of these things to actually happen in our country when other things could be happening but aren't. Mm-hmm. And we are moving in other directions. And the richer are going to get richer in our society, and there's no screaming out in our country that the 10% are getting richer and richer. Basically, we're allowing that to happen. If one weren't a preacher, maybe one would be a terrorist in our society, or at least for some people, because the way we're going, there really is no alternative for the vast majority of these people. They will continue under these present policies to get worse off. And that's back to pessimism.
Mm-hmm. And under present policies. Well, a couple of comments. One, I really recoil from conspiracy theories myself. I really do think conspiracy theories are a substitute for thought most of the time. But I do think that a deep understanding of structural and institutional racism sometimes can almost sound like a conspiracy theory. That is, when you begin lining up what's happened with the economy, what's happened with the education systems, what's happened with public policy and social services, what's happened with the healthcare system, what's happened with the plight of industry from cities, not only overseas, but to the Sun Belt and suburbs, you begin to get, all of those have racial implications. All of those are institutionally further isolating the underclass, not just black folks, but particularly heavily on black folks. Now that's not, I think that there are dynamics of the economy that explain all of that, so you don't have to get into a sort of conspiracy theory to do that. But the impact of it is sort of the same, right? If you're living at the bottom of all that stuff, it feels very much like everything's against you, and it's got to be a plot. The drug stuff is so hard. I mean, as I work in urban neighborhoods, which is my love, doing organizing stuff, that's the major change over the last 10 years. It's just, and we could even handle, we can certainly, none of this is condoning, but certainly a little grass and even heroin in some ways, but crack is something else. It's just different. It's just, crack is a total killer. And and it gets people and it locks them off the streets. I mean, heroin people, at least are out on the streets, and there is some sort of public commerce with them, and you can talk with folks, you know. But crack is just terrible. And the continuing influx of drugs into a setting where there is no other economic activity going on is devastating. It's just, you know, for me the challenge is, how do you rebuild those economies from the bottom up, from the inside out, in ways that begins to give people some options? I mean, everybody's got to be an economic person at some point, and at this point, in lots of communities, certainly the best way, and in some cases the only way, to be an economic actor is to get into the drug business. And that's really scary. One more comment on your comment. I do think that you ended up on the hopeless note. I ended up hopeful just because I was talking about Jesse. You know, all of those folks, in some way or other, have been touched by what Jack, again, whether you agree with Jackson or not, you have to admit that he has grasped people in these kinds of settings, unlike anybody has grasped them. And they feel some kind of a connection. You really can feel. I talked last week about, I was in Los Angeles for a week in April, and everybody I talked to in South Central Los Angeles said that the Jackson campaign has reinvigorated grassroots political activity in the black community in Los Angeles, unlike anything in the last 15 years. That there's more stuff going on in black churches, there's more stuff going on in black neighborhood organizations, black economic development stuff, that it's not just Jesse at the top, but there's something going on under it that's really quite exciting. And I see that somewhat in Chicago, but I don't see it as much in Chicago, because we had that happen with the election of Mayor Harold Washington already 5 years ago. So the Jackson thing sort of comes on top of that. But in Los Angeles, where things were more desperate, Jesse's had an effect. Yes?
Just to go a little bit more on what you're saying, at least I sort of see the economic shifts that you're talking about from steel workers to computer programmers absolutely have a race effect, but don't necessarily come from a race dimension. It's
not intentional.
Somewhat the free flow of the economy. Given that, if blacks do get more political and there is a conscious effort to want to do something, what's to do? To force change the economy? Or,
well, I think, it is a heck of a question, but I do think that, one of the salutary legacies of the last decade, and particularly of the Reagan years, is that people have been left to themselves. In lots of ways, people left to themselves have died and gotten desperate and gotten into illicit economies. But also, people left to themselves have begun to invent lots of absolutely fascinating ways to, in fact, reinvigorate economic and political life at the local level. I think there's more stuff going on in cities anyway, in poor communities, in terms of little business starts, little neighborhood organizations doing this, that, and the other thing. Some real sophistication in housing being built by the poor themselves than I've ever seen. Now, one set of public policy directions is to look at what's working and support it. Give it some resources, you know, pump it, and allow the poor themselves to have the direction of it. There are lots of other things, it seems to me, that probably need doing, from education to healthcare to a variety of reindustrialization kinds of proposals. But really, that is a whole other path. I do think that policy shifts can make a difference, though, in the question we're talking about, that it isn't in that way hopeless.
Mm-hmm. Well, my question was sort of a follow-on to what he already had asked. The picture you painted is that, you know, one of the things that's clearly needed is some kind of a renaissance of the urban centers. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what sort of things have been tried or have seemed to have worked. Are there any pockets, any place that there are pictures of hope that can be emulated and worked on?
Yeah, I really think there are. I mean, churches are doing a lot. We've got a little a little Lutheran congregation in the middle of the poorest West Side Chicago black community, which has over the last decade created some 600 jobs in that community, rebuilt and created some 400 units of housing in that community, involved the people themselves in defining a healthcare system that is mostly home-based and employs the people themselves, started two schools, elementary and high school, that actually graduate people who can read and write and compute and work in the economy. This is one little congregation we're talking about, one little black congregation in a neighborhood. There's no reason, and that story gets repeated really quite, you know, that's a pretty remarkable scene there, but it does get reported, repeated to some degree, over and over again. And with increasing sophistication, I think churches have moved somewhat beyond charity to thinking about development, to thinking about ways of organizing the capacities of people. I think that organizers and others have moved a little bit beyond sort of the social welfare model, that these are people who have problem upon problem upon problem, and what we have to do with them is to give them more and more professionals to solve all those problems, middle class people who come in and be social workers and health workers and psychological counselors and all the rest of it. And there is, I think, more and more recognition that people who are poor also have capacities. And if we're interested in them not being poor, you build on those capacities rather than feeding into them in some way or other. Feeding into the weaknesses. Yeah, the one other part of the economic equation we should remember, it seems to me, is that we do hear from the current administration about the creation of jobs during this decade. I think the current number that George Bush is using is 15 million new jobs created since 1980. And it is true that there are sectors of the economy that are really booming. And you talked about the computer operators. When you break down where those new jobs are, though, in the economy, it looks now like something like 70% of those new jobs pay under $7,000 a year, right? So that we're creating really a two-tiered, yeah, that's right. It is the McDonaldization of that part of the economy, right? And that isn't a first step on the ladder. There is no place to go in McDonald's from that cash register. And you don't even have to read to get there, right? You got a picture of the Big Mac, right? So that a lot of what's being touted now as economic growth is not economic growth in terms of getting somebody on the ladder.
In regards to attitudes, I'm also from the Chicagoland area.
Are you?
And I don't mean to pick on Chicago, or the suburbs. But in my lifetime, I've seen, if you will, segregated communities right outside of Chicago that have remained that way, at least as so far as blacks go, which has been, you know, most disturbing. I wondered if you know if that is widespread, how widespread that is throughout the, you know, throughout the country, and you know, your opinions and how devastating this is for so far as the attitude.
Well, you know, the integration of suburban America has proceeded at a real snail's pace, although it has proceeded, there are more middle class and professional black folks in American suburbs than there were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. There is a slight increase, and when you look at percentages, you know, they tend to multiply because you go from four blacks to eight blacks, so the number of blacks double in Berwyn or Cicero or whatever you're thinking about at the moment.
Right.
Yeah, right. But really, it's an infinitesimal trickle. It is, though, part of the larger picture of the sort of class separation in the black community. That's partly a separation of black professionals who go into the suburbs, but it's much more within city migration. That is, into middle class, black, mostly black communities within cities and away from the underclass, public housing kind of dominated areas of the city. But the suburbs haven't opened up, you know, and when you look at the distribution, you know, all of the measures of the differences in wealth between inner cities and suburban rings have expanded, have gone this way in the last 15 years, and are accelerating, actually, so that income gaps between suburban Chicago, for instance, and the city itself, continue to go to widen. You know, to some degree, when you think about cities, you really can't think about longer term solutions without metropolitanizing your solutions, without somehow figuring out how a basically impoverished central city can get hooked in with those parts of the economy, which it really still is the center for, but to receive some kind of the benefits of that. One other thing to say about the black profession, Chicago and lots and lots and lots of other older cities have seen a huge boom in downtowns, right? So you've got gleaming new downtowns. The biggest building boom by far in urban America ever has been in the last 6 years. The number of the square feet of retail office and office space in downtown Chicago has doubled just in the last 7 years. So you've got gleaming new downtowns, cheek by jowl with some of the poorest communities that are, now what do you got here? What we've got here, I think, in some ways, is the emergence of a third world model of a city where there is no more middle class, right? So that you've got just the poor and just the very wealthy within the cities. And that certainly raises a whole different set of questions for us when we think about our cities than before. Yeah, Barry, and then...
I want to just say something about busing, not to get back on the subject of busing, but to, I think in some ways, make sure we move beyond that. I do not want to argue that busing has been a success story or that it's been a great policy. On the other hand, I'm concerned that we not blame the problem of the urban schools on busing. Mm-hmm. I think it comes back to your comment right near the end, which is that what it all comes down to is what's the white response. And for me, the problem with busing is primarily not the actual busing itself, but the fact that whites pulled out of the schools. Mm-hmm. And so that the amount of resources and the priorities then given to urban schools have declined drastically. I mean, the number of whites, either even those who have stayed in the city, whose kids no longer go to public schools, has risen drastically in the last 15 years.
Yep.
And so I just think that's really important to see not the busing itself and some technical part of that policy as being necessarily the problem, but it's been the response to that. Perhaps another response might have had made a very much different kind of outcome in terms of what that particular policy might have brought about.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the same that applies to others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Well, I promised my wife I wouldn't get excited and I wouldn't say anything, but I'm breaking my promise.
It's okay. You and I argue about this stuff all the time. It's okay.
I really can't say that you can say that the white people are not concerned. They're all concerned. And all you need to do is watch TV. Look at the blacks, the progress that they've made. Once in a while, you'll see a white athlete. And the reason is that the blacks work harder than the whites do. And I come from a community where years ago they did not allow blacks in. And we do have. And one of our big products is Christmas tree. We harvest 4.9 million trees a year. And some of the blacks have come down there and applied for jobs, and they find out how tough it is and how much work it is, and they never come to work. But we hire a lot of Spanish people, Mexican people, and one of the things that has happened in the past is there's a lot of Vietnamese that have come in, and they are very ambitious. They work 7 days a week. We have this place that buys the brush and products from the land. And this one Vietnamese, he and his wife, in 8 days, made $2,800. And then the IRS come in or they and found out that these people were, they didn't pay any income tax, and that they were also on welfare. And from the Vietnamese, when they come over here, they have one fellow that's the head of the whole group, and he is kind of the leader. These people have some of the finest cars, and they own their own homes in Aberdeen. And they're very, well, you can't say that they're not ambitious because they're really hardworking. Vietnamese, there's a store outside of town, and it's a grocery store, and they have lockers there. And this fella paid $250,000 for that, and he got a 7% loan from the government to buy this. A black or any minority, if you sell to the state of Washington any products like meat and so on and so forth, you get a 5% advantage. And I think the big problem has been with, I agree with you on drugs, and I feel this, that I'm in favor of the death penalty for the pusher and also a penalty for the user. And I am
okay.
Raspberry is the, he's one of the columnists, and mm-hmm. he feels it's a mistake to throw money at people.
Mm-hmm. Ken, thank you for that. I think, you know, one of the things to do as we work our way into the multicultural future is to look at the different experiences of a variety of groups in the United States, including the new Asian groups, and figure out what is working in a lot of those communities, and figure out how to replicate that in other poor communities. So it seems to me that there is some stuff to look at there that's helpful to look at. Thank you for that. Okay, thank you all.